This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. We are, once again, talking jobs on this program. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, today, 23 January. Good as it always is to have you along, everybody. You know, it's not a secret that we here at Marketplace put significant emphasis on jobs. People having them, people keeping them, and what happens if people lose them. So with today's announcement that Spotify is going to be laying off about 6% of its workforce, jobs is where we are going to begin. Microsoft, Amazon, Salesforce, Wayfair, Alphabet, the list goes on, all of them cutting jobs. At the very same time, though, the unemployment rate, as you know, is back to 3.5%, a 50-year low, and first-time claims for jobless benefits, which can be a pretty good indicator of which way unemployment is trending, those claims are really low and they are falling. So, from the Marketplace desk of what is up with all of that, here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
Typically, when the economy slows down and companies respond by laying off lots of workers, claims for unemployment compensation spike. It's happened before with recessions looming. But not this time, says Michelle Evermore at the Century Foundation.
I think there's actually really good reasons there might not be initial claims associated with a lot of these layoffs.
First, in spite of recent layoffs, the job market is still really tight. There are lots of job openings and jobs being created, especially for workers in leisure and hospitality and healthcare.
The unemployment rate is incredibly low, so I think, you know, people have high confidence that they'll find another job relatively quickly so they don't go through the unemployment insurance process.
Then there's all the trouble people had dealing with unemployment systems during the pandemic.
Filing for unemployment is a complicated process.
Andy Challenger at outplacement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas says it's time-consuming, not everyone who loses a job is eligible, and to keep getting benefits, you have to jump through hoops, like proving you're actively looking for a new job every week. All that was on Marissa Cheeve's mind when she lost her tech job last year in Portland, Oregon.
I'm a game developer on the Roblox platform. I do all sorts of modeling, graphic design, game design.
The 22-year-old has been laid off twice in the last 2 years as the startups she was working for downsized. The first time, she wasn't eligible for unemployment because she'd been working as an independent contractor. The second time, she decided not to apply so she could keep her options open.
There's always openings, and I see them, but, you know, since my last two experiences with startups, I'm really not finding myself inclined to apply for them.
And that idea, that even amid layoffs, there are lots of job opportunities, is especially relevant for Cheeves and other workers in tech, where a lot of recent job cuts have been concentrated, says John Lear at polling firm Morning Consult.
Workers are being reabsorbed elsewhere in the economy. These higher income workers tend to be fairly highly skilled, which is allowing them to go back and re-enter the workforce as soon as they're laid off.
In many cases, before they get around to or even feel the need to apply for unemployment. Andy Challenger points out white-collar workers who get laid off are often sent packing with perks.
Lots of job cut announcements from tech firms are also announcing really generous severance packages and benefits for people as they depart.
In many states, if you take the severance, you forfeit the unemployment.
You see a lower percentage of people at the high end of the income distribution filing for unemployment because they don't either have the time, the patience, or the really deep need to file unemployment claims.
That's pretty much where Marissa Cheeves finds herself now. 9 months after losing her game development job, she's plenty busy developing a game with a few of the former coworkers she was laid off with.
It's a diesel punk game inspired by like World War I and World War II aesthetics, so there's going to be a lot of trench digging. I'm really excited for it.
For now, Cheeves is relying on savings and living frugally.
I've definitely considered getting a part-time job somewhere just to supplement my income and, you know, to help fund the project.
But so far, Cheeves says, she hasn't even considered knuckling down and applying for unemployment. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, on this Monday, in late January, traders were feeling pretty good, TBH. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's another data point out about the health of this economy today. The National Association for Business Economics does a quarterly survey of economists at businesses and industry associations. And there were, in today's report, some sightings of green shoots. But as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports, chickens, before they hatch, don't count them.
There's a game economists love to play. It's called, on the one hand, on the other hand. On the one hand, Sarah Rutledge says more economists in today's survey expect the price of materials that go into their products to fall.
The outlook for materials cost is the most favorable that it's been since the pandemic.
Rutledge is an economist with the private equity firm Stepstone Group. She says two-thirds of the survey respondents expect their firms to increase wages for the workers they're going to keep. On the other hand, there will be layoffs.
For the first time since 2020, we had more firms say they expect a decrease in their headcount than expect an increase.
Ken Simonson is chief economist for the Associated General Contractors of America.
And this is pretty rare. We've only seen this in the past during periods of recession.
And more than half the economists surveyed by NABE think the U.S. is either already in a recession or expect a downturn in the next year. Joseph Brusuelis is one of them. He's chief economist at RSM, a tax and consulting company. He doesn't think the Federal Reserve's interest rate hikes, which are meant to slow the economy, have really hit yet.
So that's why I'm in the camp that says we're likely to see economic contraction this year.
Brusuelis thinks the economy will start to contract this summer as consumer demand slows and companies' profit margins shrink because they won't be able to pass their higher costs on to their inflation-weary customers.
My sense is there's a 65% probability by the second half of the year we'll be in a very mild recession.
But on the third hand, the number of economists in the survey who agree with Brusuelis is shrinking. Remember, about 50% said they expect a recession in today's survey, but last October, almost two-thirds were in the recession camp. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Sometime later this year, seven of the biggest banks in this economy are going to join the 21st century and roll out a new digital wallet meant to compete with the likes of Apple and PayPal. The yet-to-be-branded wallet from Wells Fargo and JP Morgan, among others, will be for online transactions only, at least to start, and it will drive revenue to the banks for sure. Also, though, it's going to drive a whole bunch of data to those banks, as Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports.
Right now, if I buy something from Target using an existing digital wallet, my bank knows I spent $40.69. But not that I bought a bottle of sunscreen and size 13 toddler sneakers.
There's a whole part of your life that the bank has basically just sort of given up over to these tech companies.
Bill Maurer studies payments at the University of California, Irvine, and says the new wallet could be a way for banks to get those details.
All of which can be leveraged to drive me toward higher value products that they would offer, loans or whatever.
For example, people who are in the market for toddler sneakers may also be in the market for a house. The wallet will be managed by Early Warning Services, LLC, which is owned by several big banks and also runs the person-to-person payment app Zelle. Scott Talbot with the Electronic Transactions Association, a trade group, says when a consumer goes to buy something, they can enter the email address linked to their bank account, which pulls up all their payment info.
And allow the consumer to decide which one of their credit or debit cards they would like to use to make the purchase.
69% of American consumers use a digital wallet when shopping online, according to a survey from the consulting firm McKinsey. Marie-Claude Nadeau works in global payments there and says banks want both the revenue and the marketing that comes with these transactions.
Everyone wants a little piece of the pie, wants to make sure that consumers are engaged with their brands, not somebody else's brand.
It's possible that having more data might make it easier for early warning services to detect fraud, because it'll know if I suddenly start buying snowshoes instead of sunscreen. Again, Bill Maurer with UC Irvine.
So if you're the kind of consumer who freaks out a tiny, teeny little bit every time you click buy now on some website, maybe you'll have more peace of mind if you know you're using something that is tied to your bank.
That said, it's really hard to get people to change how they pay for things. You've got to make it more convenient or give them a deal on toddler sneakers. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Coming up.
We say we're building a sandbox.
That's not something you do every day in business school now, is it? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 254 on this Monday, 0.75%, 33,629. The NASDAQ rose 223 points. That's about 2%, 11,364. The S&P 500 up 47 points, almost 1.2%, 4,019 there. Wayfair jumped more than 26% after upgrades from several Wall Street firms, including J.P. Morgan. Last week, the furniture retailer announced it would lay off about 10% of its global workforce to, yes, cut costs. Tech stocks rallied. Apple polished up 3.2% as China's reopening stoked optimism about that company's supply chain issue and sales. Meta grew nearly 2.8% after Citi reiterated its buy for Facebook's parent firm. Salesforce improved 3% today following reports that activist investor Elliott Management has made a multi-billion dollar investment in the cloud-based software firm. Stephanie Hughes was talking to us about big banks and the new digital wallet. So, banks. Bank of America added almost 1.4% today. J.P. Morgan Chase gained 1.6%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. 1 euro today would cost you about $1.09 American, well off its recent lows, but still well below where it's historically traded, which I mentioned not for any transatlantic comparative purposes, but to point out that joint or shared currencies can be challenging. While it is still very early days yet, Brazil and Argentina are expected to announce plans for their new common currency this week. And there is, of course, upside potential if other countries in Latin America sign on. But as Marketplace's Lily Jamali reports, it is a long way from right here to over there.
The idea of having Brazil and Argentina go in on a common currency is raising the same question in many corners right now.
My initial reaction was, you know, why do this, right?
Especially if you're Brazil, says Bipin Rai, global head of foreign currency exchange strategy at CIBC.
Argentina historically has been pretty unstable environment for currencies. In fact, they've had to introduce a new currency quite frequently throughout its history.
And Argentina's currency woes are still pressing. Last year, its inflation rate hit a three-decade record of 95%. Rai says for Brazil, the attraction may come down to influence.
It would give them the same sort of clout that Germany might have over a peripheral country in the Eurozone.
Rai says Brazil's economy is much larger than Argentina's, and it wants to solidify its position as a regional powerhouse. Western Michigan University's Susan Pozo says Brazil may also be concerned about Argentina deepening economic ties with other countries.
They maybe want to forge ahead in terms of linking themselves more closely to Argentina.
She says having a common currency could ease trade between the two countries.
Trade across borders can be much more expensive when you have to think about exchange rates and potential changes in exchange rates.
But Pozo says economic integration comes at a cost. Harvard government professor Jeffrey Frieden agrees.
It eliminates or dramatically reduces each country's flexibility in their monetary policy. I think what would happen is that Argentina would be giving up its monetary policy.
A powerful tool for governing its own economy. In Europe, Frieden says integration meant combining debtor countries like Greece and Spain with creditor countries like Germany. And in the end,
the central bank can't satisfy everyone.
Despite the progress in Europe, he says the experience there should be a red flag for Brazil and Argentina, two economies on very different tracks. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
There are, generally speaking, two different kinds of conflict in and around the workplace. There is the macro kind, the layoffs we talked about up at the top of the program. The are people going to have to come back to the office post-pandemic kind, the really big picture kind. And then there's the more micro kind, the interpersonal disagreements, manager-employee tensions, tough performance reviews. And it was those, the up-close and personal conflicts, that got me to make a phone call the other day.
My name is Bree Jenkins, and I'm a leadership development associate at Pixar Animation Studios.
My name is Francesca LeBaron, and I'm professional faculty at Haas School of Business.
And the course those two taught in the MBA program at the Haas School of Business up at UC Berkeley was called Difficult Conversations Conflict Lab. 30 students in a three-hour class having those difficult conversations by role-playing them. My first question to them was, what should the students be expecting out of this class?
Yeah. Well, actually, it's interesting. I think that we spend the entire first class talking about what they should be expecting. Otherwise, they should drop the class. Our very first class.
We say our goal at the beginning of class is to get rid of at least half of you.
And that shows up really. That shows up really well on Rate My Professor, I'm sure.
Well, it's true. It's not for everyone, but we do want to build. We say we're building a sandbox. We're building a sandbox where you get to experiment when it comes to different conflict role plays and be able to say like that worked and that didn't work. Not right and wrong. We're very specific about the language we use. What was your goal? What is your objective of this conversation? And did you achieve it? It's not about being right or wrong. It's being effective.
Bree, when you went to the powers that be at Haas and said, listen, we've got this idea. And you know, in theory, Haas is training future business leaders of America. What was the elevator pitch?
Yeah, the elevator pitch was all about how we would talk to our fellow classmates, especially after Francesca and I had already started developing the class. Mm-hmm. And we said, tell me about the conflict that's happening in your workplace. And they're like, conflict? I'll tell you about the conflict. This thing happened, this person, let me tell you about this. And they would say, okay, cool. So did you talk to that person? Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, like, nah. Like,
yeah, of course not.
What am I supposed to say to them?
Right.
And they are my boss or they're my friend. I don't want to hurt their feelings. And that was probably the clearest pitch that we could have given.
Yeah. It was such a litmus test for like, is there a place for this class?
Right.
When the number one feedback we got from alumni was, I wish we had this. Number one. And number two, it was exactly what Bree said. It'd be like, oh, we're looking for role plays in class. Like, do you have any role plays? And then it would turn into like a 40-minute conversation while everyone, each of our alumni would tell us and be like, these are the like 12 conversations I'm avoiding in the workplace.
We should say here, both of you are reasonably recent graduates of Haas. So, you know, you've got a ripe alumni base and classmate base that you can pick from. Give me an example, would you, either one of you, of your favorite role plays, the ones that are most rewarding, right? Because what you want out of this experience is growth and development. So which ones get you there?
Oh, there is a lot of them.
I know. You got to pick one. Sorry.
We had a lot of conversation around an example where you had to give feedback to an employee or a direct report that was very high performing. So they like hit their numbers, did a great job, but they weren't great team players or they had interpersonal issues. So how do you give that direct report feedback of like, you're doing great at your job and you also need to be more collaborative with your teammates?
Yeah, I think that was so important for students' growth because we got to just really challenge them back and forth. So they would say, well, you're an employee who is doing really great at your job. And so we would say, oh, are they doing great at the job? What are the components of their job that are important? And if interpersonal, if dealing with interpersonal kind of relationships is an important part of the job, what are ways that we can expand that and talk about that with that person? How can you be more specific when you give the feedback? And this one just people struggled with. I don't want to lose that person. You know, it wasn't even a real person. It was just a role play. But they're like, I don't want to lose that person on my team.
Yeah. It was amazing how real the role plays got.
Yeah, I was just going
to
say.
And then we brought in undergrads to role play direct reports.
Oh, wow.
Since a lot of our MBA students will, you know, realistically be managing someone that was a recent grad from undergrad.
Sure.
And then we brought in alumni to play their managers or their clients. So it made it super real for them.
Can we talk for a second, actually, you know, asking for a friend here about having these conversations and managing up, right? Because that's way harder. That's got to be way harder than telling your direct report, listen, you need to do X, Y, and Z, and this is a tough conversation. But managing up is among the hardest things you do in an organization.
Yeah, completely. It's because there's so many dynamics that are happening. There's the power dynamics of what if I tell this person this and I'm going to get fired or something. And so we took a lot of our classes to talk about how do you deal with your emotions in these situations. Yeah. Do they get a tightened chest? Do they find it hard to think? And how then do they want to manage that in the moment? I think that was the biggest thing to realize, especially when managing up.
One thing that we focused on is kind of owning our needs in class. Yeah. I think a lot of our students we found had a hard time asking, kind of owning their needs and asking in a way where it was a request to others.
Owning their needs is really interesting because, you know, there is less so now, I think, right? But for a long time, there's been in professional life in this country, to quote Don Draper, that's what the money's for, right? You come to work, you do your job, you shut up, and we give you a paycheck, right? And mm-hmm. it is different now, which is good, but it's a different thing.
Yeah, I think one thing we've learned, particularly over working through the pandemic, is that we're all humans. And I think that bosses and organizations that kind of neglect the human, they're losing people left and right yeah. because we're not giving people a space to own their needs and ask for what they need to be successful.
I'm just going to throw this out there because there's probably some people out there listening to this. I don't know. But look, conflict avoidance is just easier, you know? And it's so easy to just not have these conversations. How do you actually, as I'm creating it in my mind, this is a really good question, right? It's great that you've got this course, but you have to convince people somehow that they should have these conversations. How do you do that?
Yeah, that's such a relevant thing. Yeah. Yeah, it's easier, but I would say it's easier for a very specified amount of time. And then it becomes harder. You've become unhappy with where you're at. You become resentful of the people that you're with. And so then your entire work life starts getting consumed by these relationships. And so all of a sudden it's not easier anymore.
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. harder. Mm-hmm. We actually did give our students though, if there were situations where they were like, you know what, engaging in this conflict is actually not going to be the thing that is most effective or beneficial, then we gave them an out. And so then we didn't have to tell them like, you need to be in this conflict, right?
Yeah. Right.
They
right.
got to tell themselves why was it important right. for them to do this or not.
Right.
Yeah.
Are you going to get re-upped for next fall? Are you back on the syllabus?
We are back on the syllabus
right,
for next
good.
Fall. Yes, we are.
Good. Congratulations. Bree Jenkins and Francesca LeBaron, they teach a course up at UC Berkeley at the Haas School of Business. It's called Difficult Conversations. And they are. Thanks, you two. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Final note on the way out today. Saw this at the BBC. Some data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture about eggs and egg prices. They are up a lot, as you probably heard, mostly because of a really bad outbreak of avian flu. Anyway, with egg prices up 60% in December from a year ago, 60%, the USDA says seizures of eggs and poultry at the borders, both of them, by the way, Canadian and Mexican, were up 108% in the fourth quarter of last year. All right, we're going. Here is your moment of economic context. We started with jobs. We are going to end with jobs because you got to be consistent, right? I mentioned in setting up Mitchell's piece that first-time claims for unemployment benefits are low and falling, and they are. But there is another component of that first-time claims report that we get every Thursday that bears a mention here. It's called continuing claims, and just like it sounds, it's people who are making ongoing claims for unemployment benefits. That number was up last week. Not a lot. 17,000 to about 1.6 million. So, again, not a lot, but it is worth, I think, keeping an eye on. Our daily production team includes Livy Burdett, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giong, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.